All right, let's go move to our third case, 20-4119, United States versus Mamat. And for the appellant is Mr. Phelps. You may proceed.
Thank you, and good morning. Yes, my name is Nathan Phelps, and I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Mamat. In this case, the court needs to grapple with the consequences of the Hayman decision. What does that mean for the supervised release penalty in 3583K? The reason that's before the court is Mr. Mamat has received a 10-year sentence, supervised release sentence under that provision. He received that sentence in 2014 before the Supreme Court decided the Hayman decision. He sought relief, post-conviction relief, afterwards. And now, admittedly, for his petition for post-conviction relief to be timely, The Hayman decision must be a substantive decision. The district court below, it disagreed. It believed that it was procedural. It believed that that because it just applied the Alain and Apprendi trial rights to the 3583K, that it was procedural, and therefore Mr. Mamat's petition was untimely. But as we argue, that is not the case. If you dig into how 3583K works, it cannot be used as a supervised release provision without coming in conflict with the statutory framework and everything else that Congress has set up around it. Most pointedly, as the government acknowledges, the rule provisions direct the judge, not a jury, specifically to decide whether a supervised release violation has occurred. That includes a violation under 3583K. So as is, the rules must be changed to allow a jury to come in.
Here what's happening functionally is we've gone from a judge finding to a jury finding, and everything else about the scheme more or less stays the same. Why isn't that does not seem particularly disruptive of what Congress was trying to do with these statutory provisions, really designed to increase sentences rather than anything else. But that just seems like just because we've changed who the fact finder is, that doesn't seem to completely mess up the congressional approach here.
I believe it does for more reasons. Just for the fact finder, the Hayman decision didn't intend to create some sort of Frankenstein provision that is half crime, half supervised release punishment. I don't think we have any such thing in our jurisprudence where, in this case, this looks like a crime, so we have to treat it like a crime by allowing a jury to hear it and to imply the reasonable doubt standard, and then to ignore all the other trial rights that go along with having a crime decided. I mean,
as a result of Hayman, what conduct became criminal or punishable that wasn't criminal or punishable before, or became not punishable now, but which was punishable before? What conduct by the defendant?
The punishment that is imposed under 3583K. It's the argument that he could have faced a punishment certainly under other statutes,
couldn't he still face those punishments if now it's done by a jury?
Not under 3583K, without disrupting the scheme and without rule changes that would allow a jury actually hear it. I mean,
The way I read that, it simply means that, yes, it would be a number of interlocking procedures that have to be changed to result in the change that Mamat might require, rather than Hayman might require, but I'm just having trouble deciding whether there is some actual conduct that has been criminalized or decriminalized as a result of this, as opposed to a kind of a complete scrambling of some of the procedures used to determine punishment.
My argument would be that the additional punishment that is available under 3583K enough, removing that out of the equation makes it substantive. Before Haymond, and without a deal with the government, he would have faced potentially the 3583K punishment and additionally a punishment for the substantive offense if the government chose to prosecute him. After Haymond, because the jury right cannot be applied and makes that provision void, he essentially faces much less punishment than he would before.
Why could the jury right not be accomplished? I mean, why couldn't an order that he does now have to have a jury, and that to the extent that the procedures didn't give him a jury, that has to be changed? Why couldn't that be done?
For a number of reasons. The primary one, as I said already, is that the rules of federal criminal procedure, direct the judge to be the fact finder. It's explicit on that point. So as is, put in the jury and have a jury decide the supervised release question without violated provision of the rules. But beyond that, if it's treated as a crime, it frustrates much of what Congress tried to do in this area. As I pointed out, it would essentially make 3583K a greater offense that includes all those offenses that are listed in there as sub-offenses or lesser included offenses. But without providing all the extra restitution, the extra punishment that's provided under those statutes. I mean, under 3583K, you face a 5-year minimum. But if you commit a kidnapping, which is one of the predicate offenses under 3583K, you face, I believe, 20 or 25 years if you kidnap a minor. So, in some sense, yes, it is advantageous for defendants to receive punishment under this provision if it's to avoid those other punishments. The trouble is they face both. There is not an either or.
Well, there's no doubt that 3583K provides more punishments, more severe punishments now. But Haymond didn't address severity of punishments. Haymond didn't say that's the problem with 3583K. Haymond said the problem is that they didn't get a jury and a judge. I mean, a jury and a beyond reasonable doubt standard. So isn't that the problem that has to get fixed? And if it can get fixed, then I guess on remand we say fix it. If it can't get fixed, I guess then we say you can't impose the additional punishment. But I don't see how we, it seems to me to say that we ought to throw out other parts of 3583K that deal with enhanced punishments is a kind of a baby and bathwater thing, because those other parts were never criticized by the Supreme Court.
I believe they focused on the last two sentences, which includes both limits or increases the limit of what punishment can be imposed. Normally, but for 3583K, Mr. Mehmet would have faced punishment under 3583E, where he would have faced at most 2 years punishment. Because the judge found that he committed a crime, under 3583K, he instead faced a minimum of 5. And a maximum of life. Now that's quite the change. Now, of course, in Haymond, the focus was on the minimum, but that was for specific reason. The judge in the Haymond case said, I want to impose a more like a 2 or 3 year sentence, not the 5 year that I have to, but my hands are tied. And that's why that was the focus, both by both the plurality and the Justice Breyer's concurrence. But I don't know how you can say that Elaine applies to 3583K when Elaine's where Elaine comes from Apprendi, and Apprendi is offended by the same provision. This is
it makes my head spin, but you're doing your best. Thank you. it is a web. Thank you.
Oh, I understand. This is exactly the problem that the Supreme Court left for this court to decide. The remedies were not raised in this court in the Haman case. And so when the government suggested that the jury could be impaneled and fix the problem, the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to send it back to this court to figure out whether that would work. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view.
Can I ask you about that? Well, the judge clearly remanded it to the 10th Circuit to figure out in Haman. Do we have the authority to decide whether Haman is to be applied retroactive or not, or does that have to be decided by the Supreme Court?
I believe in this case that this court has the authority to, because they've laid out that these rules apply. You're just putting them into effect, looking at the remedy, what that means for these provisions. But that's not I apologize. The government didn't raise that point, so I'm not prepared to speak at length about that.
Yeah.
No courts found it retroactive yet.
That's true. But also because they haven't dealt with what does it mean to impanel a jury. I'm not sure if a jury has ever been impaneled to resolve this yet. And when that happens, then the question will come: well, what happened? What consequences stem from that? And as my briefing shows, I believe the consequences frustrate what Congress was trying to do, was add a separate supervised release penalty. But if you treat it as a crime, that frustrates what Congress was trying to do. Are there any other questions? I will reserve my time now.
Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from Ms. Williams for the government.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Jennifer Williams for the United States. I'll start by addressing the last question the panel asked. We do believe the court has the authority to decide whether the Haman decision should apply retroactively, but we do not believe that it needs to reach the question of a remedy, in this case, the impaneling of a jury, at all, in order to decide whether the Haman decision is retroactive to cases on collateral review. And I'll briefly explain why. Mr. Mehmet's 2255 is only timely if Haman announced a substantive decision that would be retroactive on collateral review. And as this court has already found in its unpublished decision in Salazar, Haman announced a procedural rule because it did not change the range of conduct or the class of persons punished under 3583K. And we're not aware of any court that has in fact held that Haman announced a substantive decision. Every court that has considered the issue that we're aware of has held, as this court did, that it announced a procedural rule. And that is, in fact, the correct holding.
What do you say about the Supreme Court opinion in Welch? Doesn't that make it fairly clear that this is substantive?
No, in fact, we think that Welch supports our position that it's procedural. Welch discussed whether the decision in Johnson was procedural or substantive. And Johnson, if the Supreme Court held in Welch that Johnson announced a substantive rule, but that's because Johnson addressed the Armed Career Criminal Act. And what it did was to make certain conduct that had been criminal before no longer criminal.
Isn't that what happened? Welch specifically says that it's substantive if it, quote, narrows the scope of a criminal statute, end quote.
But Welch also talked about procedural rules, and it explained that a procedural rule is one that changes, it allocates decision-making authority between a judge and a jury. And so cases like Apprendi and Alleyne, and then the decision in Ring which was addressed in this later Supreme Court decision in Shiro, those are procedural rules because what they say is not that certain conduct is no longer criminal, but that the operative facts have to be decided by a jury instead of a judge. And that is exactly what the Supreme Court did in Haymond. It simply said—
It didn't apply Elaine in Haymond.
Breyer's well, the plurality opinion. Talked about Elaine quite a bit.
Breyer's opinion is the opinion of the court, isn't it?
It is, yes. And Breyer's opinion focused on judge-found facts.
And he specifically said he was not applying.
What he said is that he would not transfer wholesale the Elaine line into the supervised release context because, of course, 3583K is not the only provision for supervised release. There's also 3583E, which is the main supervised release provision. And what Justice Breyer said was he wanted to make it clear that he did not think the Apprendi line of cases applied wholesale to all supervised release revocation proceedings. He thought the problem with 3583K in particular was that there was a mandatory minimum that had to be applied based on findings made by the judge. And that was the problem he identified. The problem he identified was exactly the problem discussed by the Supreme Court in Welch, which is the allocation of decision-making authority between a judge and a jury. That is, as the Supreme Court explained in Welch, and as it explained in Ring, which again discussed aggravating factors under Arizona law for imposition of the death penalty, where the problem is the procedure used, facts found by a judge where they should be found by a jury, that announces a procedural rule. And a procedural rule is not retroactive on collateral review. And in fact, the court in Welch explained why that's so. It talked about the balance between the need for finality in criminal cases and the countervailing imperative to ensure that criminal punishment is imposed only when authorized by law. And Welch discussed how the need for finality takes precedence when the rule announced is procedural. And it explained that the chance of a more accurate outcome under the new procedure normally does not justify the cost of vacating a conviction whose only flaw is that its procedures conform to then existing constitutional standards. And again, that is directly applicable to the rule announced in Haymond. It's not that Haymond made certain conduct no longer criminal. It simply said that if you're going to apply these enhanced penalties, that the facts need to be, it's constitutionally insufficient for them to be found by the judge. And they need to be found by a jury. That was the holding in Haymond, and that is a procedural holding. And so our position is that in deciding the question of retroactivity and the procedural versus substantive distinction, the court doesn't reach the question of the actual remedy and whether what empaneling a jury and whether empaneling a jury is consistent with congressional intent. Because in fact, the Supreme Court in its decisions announcing procedural rules has never considered the question of a remedy. It has looked to the function of a rule, as the Supreme Court discussed in Welch and Shiro, and it's determined whether the function of the rule makes it procedural or substantive. As far as I'm aware, it has not gone the extra step. And as Mr. Mehmet suggests, this court should looked at the practical impact of that rule in deciding whether the rule is procedural or substantive.
So what do you think should happen here? Because we really can't ignore the practical impact. So, and the Supreme Court has said, okay, 10th Circuit, you guys figure it out first, and then we'll reverse you. What do you think we should say happens, and who does it for Mehmet?
This case presents a different question. Our argument is that this case only, because it arises on collateral review, what the court should do in this case is what it did already in Salazar, which is find that the rule announced is procedural and not substantive, and so the 2255 is untimely. Our position is that this is not the case for the court to decide the question left open in Haymond, which is the question of remedy. That question would be properly presented in a case on direct appeal, And in fact, there appears to be a case on direct appeal that is currently pending before this court that I found. It's fully briefed. Argument hasn't yet been set, but that would be the case.
What is the name of that case?
So that case is United States versus Shakespeare, and it's case number 218010. And that case arises on a direct appeal because the district court revoked supervised release under 3583K, and Mr. Shakespeare also pled guilty to new criminal charges based on the same conduct. And so on appeal, he raises the claims that Mr. Mehmet raises, we believe improperly in this case, about the jury remedy and questions of double jeopardy and all those issues that might arise. But our position in this case is that because it arises on collateral review, those questions aren't. This court can dispose of this case very simply, again, based on what it said in Salazar, which is Haman announced a procedure, a prototypical procedural rule.
If we disagree on that, though, don't we have to answer the remedy question in this case?
If the court thinks that it needs to look at the remedy to decide whether the rule is procedural or substantive, then yes, the court would look at the remedy, and I can address the question of remedy. But again, I would just emphasize that the Supreme Court, in deciding whether its rules are procedural or substantive, has never looked at the question of remedy. And in fact, the Ring was the decision which held that Arizona, that the aggravating factors for the death penalty had to be found by a jury. And in Shiro, the Supreme Court discussed Ring and concluded that it announced a procedural decision. And the Supreme Court did not look at the question of remedy in deciding whether Ring was procedural or substantive. It looked at the function of the Arizona statute, and it talked about the allocation of decision-making authority. And because what Ring said is that these facts have to be found by a jury instead of a judge, it announced a procedural rule. And in fact, Mr. Mehmet's position would allow defendants to attempt to transform procedural rules into substantive rules, impermissibly, in our opinion, by looking at the question of remedy in a way the Supreme Court has never suggested is appropriate. But going to specifically to your question, Judge Timkovich, yes, if the court disagrees, then it would look to the question of remedy. And we believe that, as we discussed in our Supreme Court briefing, but the Supreme Court didn't address it, and as we addressed in our brief in this court, that impaneling a jury is consistent with congressional intent in enacting 3583K in the first instance.
So we would simply remand for this issue to be determined by a jury, vacate the other determination and remand for a jury, and make no other rulings about the language in 3583 would not address the enhanced penalties available under 3583. I mean, would those stand without challenge?
Well, the part of 3583K that the Supreme Court held was unconstitutional was the judge found facts. But this court would first need to conclude that Haman announced a substantive rule to make the 2255 timely. And I suppose it would do that by, well, there are a number of steps that the court would have to go through to arrive at a remand for a jury to decide the operative facts.
What are the steps? Would we have to say that there's a whole lot of other rules that are implicated and that needs to be briefed? Would we have further briefing? Would we just ignore the other rules? What would we do?
Well, so we're assuming that the court decides.
We'd have to.
Well, Mr. Mehmet's position is that his 2255 is timely, yeah, and so that 3583K is void. And so
why would 3583 be void You think that we would, that the necessary consequence is that we void the whole rule?
Well, that's his position. That's Mr. Mehmet's position.
I know.
Our position is that even if the court reaches the question of having a jury impaneled to address these facts, that is a permissible remedy, and so it's not void.
All right. Go ahead. That's sufficient for me. Thank you.
I mean, in that case, though, so that gets to the latter half of the arguments we make in the brief. If the court reaches the issue and it determines that 3583K is not void because it is possible to have a jury and that having a jury would fix the constitutional problem identified in Haymond, then the court addresses Mr. Mehmet's as applied challenge, which is the decision in Haymond as applied to him made his sentence unconstitutional. And that's our argument, that no justice in Haymond suggested, unlike the defendant in Haymond, Mr. Mehmet here admitted the operative facts. So he didn't challenge the facts that led to the imposition of the 3583K sentence. So he admitted that.
Does that constitute direct waiver, but does that moot this need for a hearing completely because of his admission? I mean, how does that, I don't quite understand how that plays into the issues before us. The government says, well, he's admitted to what you're worrying about, how the fact would be found or not by a jury or judge. You're worried about it. You don't need either one of them to find that because we've got an admission of that. How does that all play in here?
Well, it plays in, again, our primary argument is that the court doesn't reach the issue because the rule is procedural. And so his 2255 is untimely, and so the court never addresses that issue.
Right, but let's say we say it's substantive, that gets over the procedural.
And then there are two issues for the court to look at. One is whether 3583K is void. And of course, if it's void, it doesn't apply to anybody.
That is the whole rule or just part of the rule?
I see my time has expired.
Go ahead and answer, please. Yeah.
Well, it's the part of the rule that applies the enhanced penalties based on judge found facts. So determined that there was just no way that having a jury was completely inconsistent with congressional intent and there was no remedy and 3583K was void, then even though he admitted the operative facts, it wouldn't apply to Mr. Mehmet. But so our claim is twofold. One, it's not void because there can be a jury. And then an as-applied challenge, as applied to Mr. Mehmet. And so that's the answer to your question. I'm sorry, Judge Abell. That is the answer to your question. It does not need to go back for a jury in his case, because he admitted the operative facts. And no justice in Haymond would have suggested that there was a constitutional problem where the defendant admitted to the facts. So the problem identified in Haymond was the defendant did not admit to the facts and the judge found them. That problem doesn't exist here because he admitted to the facts. So assuming, as we argue, that 3583K is not void, his 2255 is, sorry.
Well, was his admission comprehensive and complete enough to satisfy that requirement of 3583, or was it too narrow?
Well, there's no suggestion in Haymond. Haymond was concerned, again, with judge-found facts. And in fact, the plurality clearly said that its discussion, it doesn't constitute the holding, but the plurality would not have applied the requirement of a jury in a case where the defendant admitted the facts. And I believe the concurrence as well suggests that, and the Supreme Court has never found that there's a problem in all of these cases, Apprendi, Alene, all these cases that address this issue, the constitutional problem doesn't arise where the defendant admits to the operative facts.
Thank you. I see I've dragged you beyond your time. appreciate your answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the extended argument. That was helpful. Let's hear Mr. Phelps has some rebuttal, please.
Yes, I'll begin with the issue of his admissions. And it kind of ties in with everything else. I filed a 28J raising the Supreme Court's decision in Class. And Class makes clear that you can still challenge the power of the government to punish you, even if you admit to the facts that go to that the crime that they're charging you with. In Class, he was challenging due process notice and the Second Amendment, whether the gun restriction at the Capitol was valid under the Second Amendment. And the, you know, a large majority of the Supreme Court said, yes, he admitted to all those facts, but if the government can't call him in and punish him, it doesn't matter his admissions. Nothing about his challenge refutes his admissions. And that's Mr. Mehmet's argument here. It's not an as-applied challenge. It's that with 3583K, Congress tried to accomplish something that it could not in the framework that it placed it. I mean, if you look at, by comparison, 18 U.S.C. 2260A, I believe I have that citation right, it largely overlaps. If a person on that's required to register commits a certain number of crimes listed there, they face a 10-year additional punishment beyond whatever else is out there. But Congress tried to do that sort of same thing in the supervised release context. And because it increases the punishment, because it offends Elaine and Apprendi, it just doesn't work. And so it's not as applied. The provisions themselves just cannot work without, you know, basically putting this court in the role of the legislature and rewriting how these provisions work.
Do you think we're less a legislature by striking 3583 than if we were simply to say we're going to strike only the offending parts of 3583?
If that was an option, that would be the preferred option. But as my briefing lays out, it just doesn't work. You'd also have to strike the innocuous provision that the judge must find these facts. And then you have to deal with, would Congress really have intended to create a criminal offense that would include as lesser included crimes that have greater punishment? But that's all in the briefing. One final word is just that Welch said, look at the function of what the rule accomplishes, not what the constitutional guarantee that is involved. And I make this point in the briefing, but in Davis, that's exactly what the government tried to do, is say it could be reinterpreted, be procedural, and they failed, and so the Supreme Court struck it down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the argument, bringing some light to the darkness here. You are excused, and the case is submitted.